Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If you're thinking that the radio's full of dreck, then it's time to listen to Soundcheck.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Here's a music trivia question for you. Well, I mean, it's not really trivia if everyone knows the answer, but here goes. What is the biggest selling record of all time? Did you say Thriller by Michael Jackson? That is correct. Now, here's the hard part. How many copies of Thriller did Michael Jackson sell? I'm going to say 100 million. 80 million. No, 120 million. All right, come on. One of those has got to be right. Right? I mean, the record industry keeps saying 100 million. Thriller's own producer, Quincy Jones, ups it to 120 million in his memoir. I know that seems implausible, but somebody's got to be able to figure out how many copies of Thriller are out there. I know. We'll ask Bill Wyman, the music writer. He'll figure this out for us. And once we've gotten to the bottom of this, we'll reward ourselves with some hard-partying dance music from the band Red Bharat, playing their blend of Punjabi folk and American funk here in the studio. But first, as they used to say on the old Monty Python show, something completely different. In the 1970s, punk first exploded here in New York, centered around clubs like the legendary CBGB's, and along with the bands, a magazine was born that had the same raw energy and gritty feel. For 4 years, the magazine chronicled and even helped define many of the names and faces of the time. It was called simply Punk. Now, a new book collects the very best of those 4 years. It is called, predictably, Punk, the Best of Punk Magazine. And the publication's co-founder, John Holmstrom, joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. John, welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So very early on in the book, you put to bed a common misconception about Punk Magazine, which is that you guys came up with the term punk for this music.
Punk rock had been a term that had been in use for several years. Cream magazine put Alice Cooper on the cover as Punk of the Year in 1974. Every time I'd read Cream, I'd read about punk rock, so I thought everybody in the world knew what it was. And now Suicide are generally acknowledged as possibly the first ever punk band.
Except that what year are we talking about with Suicide? That's
1970 to
it's really early.
Whenever, yeah. Oh, yeah. They were the first band to call themselves punk on a promotional poster, and they really did that stripped-down minimalist sound, except they were a keyboard and a singer and a drum machine.
Right.
So people thought of them, well, they can't be punk because they're techno.
So the idea of punk as, you know, a couple of electric guitars, maybe a bass guitar and drums at full throttle, that idea hadn't, you know, that wasn't the definition of punk yet. There was no definition of punk yet. And that seems to be where you guys came in, Punk Magazine. In fact, you actually came up with a definition of punk, didn't you? Or a kind of a list of characteristics that define something as punk.
Yeah, I thought there was a common thread throughout the New York City rock scene at that time. Glam rock had kind of run its course, and there was kind of an anti-fashion look of the bands. But originally, punk rock meant what we now call garage rock. It was referring to the 1960s post-Rolling Stones bands.
Yeah.
And that attitude is what a lot of people think made you a punk. Like the Ramones came along, and people were saying, oh, my God, their songs are only 2 minutes long. And you go back to the Beatles' first records, all the songs are 2 minutes long.
The whole side of the record goes by in 13 or 14 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the late 60s, early 70s, you had, you know, post Sgt. Pepper, you had the rise of psychedelia, of progressive rock, and songs got longer and longer and longer. And the punks were really, as you say, they were kind of looking way back to the roots of rock and roll. And you mentioned the Ramones. I want to come back to them in a bit. But the Dictators, this was a band that meant a lot to you personally, right?
Yeah, well, I got that first record in the summer of 75, and I loved it because it was funny. The Dictators' Go Girl Crazy is the actual title of that record.
And what was it about this band that stood out for you?
To me, it was their sense of humor. It was funny, and rock and roll had stopped being funny by the 60s. All those people took themselves so seriously. And you go back to the great rock and roll, like the Coasters, you know, the novelty song. That's the kind of thing I liked.
Well, let's hear the Dictators. We're speaking with John Holmstrom, the cartoonist, writer, and co-founder of Punk Magazine from 1976 to 79. And this is from the album The Dictators Go Girl Crazy. I used to shiver in the wings, but then I was young. I used to shiver in the wings until I found my own tongue. I suck up everywhere that I sing, 'cause you know, baby, I'm the next big thing. Dictators with The Next Big Thing from their album The Dictators Go Girl Crazy, some classic punk from the mid-70s. John Holmstrom's with me on Soundcheck. He's the co-founder of Punk Magazine, and the new book is called Punk, The Best of Punk Magazine, collected from the 17 issues that were published between 1976 and 79. So, John, what made Punk Magazine different? It was not specifically a music magazine. I mean, it was called Punk, and it certainly, you know, you put people like Lou Reed and the Ramones and Debbie Harry of Blondie on the cover, but it seemed to be as much about art as it was about the music.
Yeah, it was art and humor. We wanted to be like the Mad Magazine of rock and roll.
And in terms of choices, decisions that were made of who to put on the cover, who to go after for interviews and stuff. As a startup in 1976, in a whole scene of startups, you end up with Lou Reed on the cover of the first issue, a guy who already had a long track record. Tell the story of how that happened.
Well, that was kind of an accident. If I had had my choice of who to put on the cover, our first choice was the Dictators. Or I would have put Alice Cooper because he was the punk of the year and all that. But we went to interview the Ramones for the cover, and then he happened to be in the audience. And I was a big fan, especially because
this
is
at CBGB's.
At CBGB's. Mm-hmm. He's just hanging out. And I had been a big fan of, still am a big fan of his Metal Machine Music, which is a double album of nothing but guitar feedback and tape noise. I was thrilled to talk to him about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me a great interview. And that put us on the map.
Right. And offered to buy your reel-to-reel tape deck from you.
Yeah, I had this little reel-to-reel recorder. I wasn't a professional interviewer. I'd never talked to anybody before.
Uh-huh.
So Lou saw this thing. Everybody was fascinated by it. But I got it from my uncle, who was an early sound fanatic. He had a recording studio in his basement, you know, going back to the 50s. And
so you would travel around with this thing, record your interviews, and then take it home or to the office, and you would hand write the transcriptions for the magazine.
Well, first I would transcribe it, and then I would hand letter an edited transcript.
So the magazine punk, as you say, it's music, it's art, it's also humor. And in the book, in Punk, the Best of Punk magazine, you reference a band called The Sweet, and their song Ballroom Blitz is a kind of like, you know, almost a point of reference, a touchstone for bands like the Ramones and the other early punks. What did you mean by that?
Well, I really think Blitzkrieg Bop was inspired by Ballroom Blitz, mm-hmm. as well as the Bay City Rollers. Early on,
The Bay City Rollers, they were this Scottish kind of boy band, mm-hmm. Very kind of squeaky clean image. I'm saying the image.
No,
I know what the reality was.
Okay.
But, you know, they were sort of sold to the public as like, this is music for your teenage daughters to listen to.
But you know, Bernard Brooke Partridge, who prevented the Sex Pistols from performing in the Great Britain back in the day, said there's only one band worse than the Sex Pistols, and that's the Bay City Rollers. So,
yeah, they were a randy lot of young men, weren't they?
That's what I heard. I never saw the show, but I've heard they were obscene.
I'll keep on dancing to the rock and roll on Saturday night. Saturday night, dancing to the rhythm in our heart and soul on Saturday.
So the kind of dual influences of bands like the Bay City Rollers and the Sweet, this is part of the mix that gives us the Ramones.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a better name now for what they did back then would be heavy metal bubblegum. You remember bubblegum music, right?
Yep. Kind of the lightest and frothiest of the pop.
Yeah, but it's kind of punk when you listen to it.
Yeah.
It kind of kept that going through the 60s.
The song we're talking about by The Sweet, Ballroom Blitz, was actually released in 1973, although it didn't really gain traction here in the States till 75. This is that song. That is The Sweet with their song Ballroom Blitz, kind of a major talking point in the development of the Ramones, of their sound, what came to be known as punk, but which, as John Holmstrom, co-founder of Punk Magazine, just told us, could easily have been called something completely different. Heavy metal bubblegum, was that your offering?
Yeah. It might have been a better name because the name punk took on a negative stigma from the beginning, and a lot of people just wanted to squash it.
Yeah, although, and you talk about this towards the end of the book, as, you know, recriminations are coming in from fans of bands that you didn't write about or fans of bands you did write about and didn't get signed, that the term punk was kind of a double-edged sword, you know. For some bands, like the Ramones and Blondie, being associated with the punk movement gave them a certain cachet and certainly helped get them their major record deals.
Right. And then once they got the record deal, nobody wanted to play the record because it was punk. I remember a story. Debbie Harry went to do an interview somewhere, and the DJ was afraid to talk to her because she might have a switchblade knife or something. You know, people took it very strange back then.
Well, now, let's talk a little bit about Blondie and especially about Deborah Harry. I mean, you know, there's photos of her in the – there's one photo of her in the book here wearing only a guitar.
I think one hidden weapon in Blondie's repertoire was Chris Stein. Now, Chris took those pictures of Debbie.
Mm-hmm.
Chris went to the School of Visual Arts, as I did, and a lot of people who worked on punk. And he's a very accomplished photographer. And he made Debbie look good.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think either one of them would have done anything that they felt was over the top.
Mm-hmm. She was one of the covers of the punk magazine. And again, the book is called Punk, the Best of Punk Magazine. So you get these images of Deborah Harry of Blondie, of Lou Reed. You did eventually get the Ramones on the cover. Let's hear a couple of excerpts from some of the artists that graced the cover of Punk Magazine, including the Ramones' Blitzkrieg Bop, a little bit of Blondie, and also later on, The Clash. Just some of the artists who were on the cover of old punk magazine between 76 and 79. The Ramones, who were supposed to be on the first cover, ended up on the third after Lou Reed was your first cover boy, John Holmstrom. We heard Blondie. And then The Clash, they were the last cover, right? The issue 17.
Yeah, The Clash were the last printed magazine.
Now, the Punk Magazine, I was telling you this before we went on mic today. I mean, I used to see the magazine, but I never actually bought a copy. I mean, I just didn't have the money. Was that the common problem? Was no one had money to buy the magazine? Is that why it eventually stopped?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. At first, that's what kept us struggling, is nobody was buying the magazine. We were only selling a few thousand copies in the States. In England, we were selling thousands of copies. It took off there. Like, the punk scene became big in London, as everybody
mm-hmm,
knows.
Mm-hmm.
It never really took off in the States until we were going out of business. By the time we'd finally gotten our act together, distributing the magazine and getting people to buy it, everybody thought punk was dead. And even though it was just beginning, the perception in the record industry was that we were finished. So it was a very strange situation to be in.
You mentioned Chris Stein before, the guitarist from Blondie, you know, photographer, took those images of Deborah Harry. At the end of the book, towards the very end, he tells you, you got to move the magazine up to the Bronx. This rap thing is going to be huge. And, of course, as you point out, he was right. He was always right. Why didn't you do it?
Well, it's not my music. I didn't have any passion for it myself. If I wanted to just make money, I guess I should have done that. But Chris was always one of my closest confidants, one of our most important contributors. Blondie and Chris were in, I think, every issue except for the first. Even though they were becoming, you know, big time and famous, they always had time to do something with the magazine, because they really loved it, and we were great friends throughout those years. And later, he's a great guy, very smart too,
and a great musician. The book is Punk, the Best of Punk Magazine, and there's an event, kind of a book release happening at the Powerhouse Arena Book release party in Dumbo on Friday night, January 11th. And is that likely to bring all the old gang back together?
Yeah, we have almost everyone who ever worked on the magazine, art directors, illustrators, writers, photographers from all over the country converging on this place to sign books.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very excited. This is the big reunion. It's also my birthday.
Very nice. All right. So that's Friday night at the Powerhouse Arena in Dumbo, the Dumbo section of Brooklyn. We've been speaking with John Holmstrom, cartoonist, writer, co-founder of Punk Magazine, which ran from 1976 to 1979. And John, a walk down memory lane. Thanks for taking it with us today.
Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed being on the program.
This is Soundcheck.
One way or another, I'm gonna find you. I'm gonna get you one way or another. I'm gonna win you. I'm gonna get you one way or another. I'm gonna see you. I wanna meet you one day. Maybe next week I'm gonna meet you. I'll meet ya.
I will drive past your house, and if the lights are on.
Up next, Michael Jackson's Thriller is the best-selling album in history, but just how many copies has it sold? Music writer Bill Wyman tried to get to the bottom of it, and he thinks he has a pretty good estimate thanks to one French fan of the King of Pop. Later, live music in our studio from the Bhangra funk group Red Bharat. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Yesterday on the show, we talked with Joe Levy about year-end sales figures for the music industry, and for the second straight year, Adele's album 21 was the top seller. It sold 4.4 million copies. Adele is selling records at an unusually good pace for today's music industry, but she has a long way to go if she's going to try to top this 1982 classic. Michael Jackson's album Thriller is generally considered to be the top-selling album of all time, but determining how many copies the album sold isn't so easy. The music critic Bill Wyman recently wrote about Thriller's sales numbers for the New Yorker website, newyorker.com. He joins me from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Hi, Bill.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. So the legend is that Thriller sold 100 million copies worldwide, which is a suspiciously round number, but did that really happen?
It really honestly seems not. It was a huge record. It was a global phenomenon, and it probably sold 65 million records as far as I can tell from my own researches, but talking to people who actually know about these figures, and nowhere near 100 million.
So where does that myth come from? Who started it?
There's a number of them. I've heard of a number of things that about 10 years ago, people said that he sold 50 million, mm-hmm. which is kind of close, probably a little bit more. And then there was something where the Guinness Book of World Records said he sold 54. And then there was this meme for a while that he'd sold 104, where it just seemed people added them together. But there's been no – I would be more respectful of the figure if somewhere someone had actually published something that explained how they got to 100 million. But it's entirely assertions by people who have no idea what they're talking about.
Well, but in the case of Quincy Jones, he must have some idea. I mean, he produced the record and he has like two conflicting numbers, doesn't he?
Right. That was one of the funny things I mentioned. The piece I was reading is one of his memoirs, and he said it sold 100 million copies, and I rolled my eyes. And then 10 pages later, it was up to 120 million. And I thought, wow, that is a very fast sales rate.
Yeah.
And now, it's funny because Motown and Jackson had a very, as I say in the piece, a very fungible relationship to the truth when it came to PR things. Jackson, his age, they shaved a couple years off of his age when he started. And so much of what came out of Motown wasn't true or was just blather. They were very good about staying on message. And nowhere in the Jackson camp releases on this has anyone shown any tendency to kind of be honest about these things, which is their prerogative. I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with journalists and reputable news outlets who kind of repeat these figures. There's a lot of lack of knowledge, even among music writers, about how sales figures in the industry actually work. paradoxically, on both sides. I mean, A, the artists and the labels sort of inflate the sales numbers because they can say, oh, it's platinum, it's double platinum, and so mm-hmm. forth. And then B, behind the scenes, when it comes to charting up the actual sales, the record labels, of course, you know, underpay artists routinely on their royalties. So it's one of the typical creative dishonesties of the record industry.
So out of one side of their mouth saying, hey, we sold 100 million records, and on the other side saying, hey, artists, we only sold about 10 million records. Here's your royalties.
Exactly.
All right. Now, somewhere in the middle, obviously, lies the truth. How yesterday when we were talking about Adele and how she was the first record of the SoundScan era to be number one for 2 years in a row, the SoundScan era begins in 1991. And it's, you know, pretty – it seems like it's a pretty methodical, well-organized way of tabulating how albums – how many albums are actually sold. Before 1991, so in the Thriller era, how were sales tabulated?
It was done by what you think would be a good methodology, which is calling around to record stores and asking people what was selling. And I'm not a huge student of it, and someone from Billboard can probably get a little more granular. But when I was a kid growing up, I worked at a record store, and once in a while you'd pick up the phone and it would be someone from Billboard asking you what was selling. Mm-hmm. And you'd say, oh, Supertramp, Breakfast in America, Doobie Brothers,
right.
Minute by Minute. Those things are selling like hotcakes.
So you think-
But you kind of wouldn't say country. There was some obvious flaws in the methodology. The biggest one was albums debuting at number one. That today, every album debuts at number one. It's very rare for an album to sort of fight its way up to number one. And back then, it was extraordinarily rare. And that doesn't mean buying patterns changed. It means the methodology was flawed. SoundScan is excellent because it actually comes from barcode scanners of actual sales.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows how bad the previous methodology was. And it was the best they could do at the time. Now, the other thing that we had at the time was the RIAA, the record industry itself, the gold and platinum certifications.
Right.
The flaw, methodological flaw there was that it's based on what they call shipments. And it would be fairly rigorous. They'd go to the pressing plants and they'd say, look, we printed up, you know, 1.2 million copies of this album and we sent it out of the Culture Club album or whatever, right? But the problem was that there was a big problem with returns, that you'd send a super particular record store 75 units of something and they'd send back 25 when they were unsold, so they would get the credit for them from the record company. You could always get credit on returns, mm-hmm. right?
Well, we're talking about trying to get some kind of real sense of how many records Michael Jackson sold, how many copies of Thriller, which is generally considered the best-selling album of all time, and the number that has been thrown out there of 100 million copies seems dubious at best. Bill Wyman has written about this for The New Yorker. He's also editor of the blog Hitsville. So you have this really questionable mythology about Michael Jackson's Thriller and the 100 million copies sold. What did you do to try and figure out what, you know, at least a kind of genuine ballpark figure for global sales?
It's such a great question. And this has always bothered me my whole life as a journalist, because you just know that these figures are often wrong. To give you one just example, when it comes to gold and platinum ratings by the RIAA, if it's a double record, it gets double credit. Okay, so there's a lot of basic information about how the certification works that people don't know in journalism.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is I stumbled upon this guy from France. His name is Guillaume Vieira, and there's a site in Britain called UK Mix where there's a lot of discussion about this. And he's this obsessive collector of actual industry announcements about record sales. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So say if in the Netherlands they say Adele sold 400,000 copies, right?
Okay.
Well, he take, because the Netherlands is a very small country, so that's a lot of records.
That's a lot of records, yeah.
So he just takes note of that and just starts adding it up, right? And you, once you start adding those figures up from all the developed countries, you really have a pretty close approximation of how many records actually were sold. So he has been doing this. He's a Michael Jackson fanatic, and he made some posts on there that were just unbelievable. It goes on for hundreds, if not thousands, of lines of data that he has collected from all these places. And once you start totaling that up, you have RIAA certification in America of about 30 million for Thriller. But you can say it's sold a few more million since Michael Jackson died.
Right.
And then he finds about 30, 35 overseas, right? From every country, Japan, Hong Kong, Australia, France, Germany, every major country you can think of. And it comes up to about another 35, which comes out to, let's say, 65 million. The chances of there being another 35 million in sales out there that have just somehow mysteriously happened where nobody ever took note of them just seems pretty far-fetched.
Right.
And so I like his methodology a lot. And he knows people in different countries in the different record industries, and he cross-checks and he looks at traditional sales patterns, like what the percentage of Europe sales France is and Germany is and Italy is. And so he really defends his data very rigorously.
So on this guy Guillaume Vieira's list of the best-selling records of all time, and these are global figures, it is Michael Jackson on top with Thriller, but at 66.2 million copies, which is a boatload of copies, but not 100 million.
Right, and that's a lot. I mean, that's phenomenal. When you look at the list, the second one is the soundtrack to Grease at 44 million. And to me, the significance is that Jackson sold half again as much as the next runner-up, which is a pretty extraordinary achievement.
And number three, Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, also at 44 million, just a relative handful of records behind the soundtrack from Grease. Did that surprise you to see Grease at number two?
Well, I had known that Grease, The Bodyguard, and Saturday Night Fever, this trio of soundtracks, were perennially massive sellers worldwide. And I had thought that Dark Side of the Moon was second, but it looks like Grease has been selling more and more, mm-hmm. that it's kind of separated from the pack of the other ones. So I think that'll probably stay at two for a long time. And you got to give these records credit. Grease is a double record too, and any of these that are double records, that costs a lot more.
Right.
So they should get a little bit of notice for that.
Well, let's give credit where due to the folks who wrote and produced the soundtrack to Grease, the number two selling album of all time, according to this list put together by the stats-obsessed French fan Guillaume Vieira. A bit of music from Grease, the soundtrack, which is at number two on the list of all-time best-selling records. These are global sales. We're speaking with Bill Wyman, who was trying to find out the truth about how many albums Michael Jackson sold, how many copies of Thriller. The industry figure of 100 million seems to have been wildly inflated, although certainly the 66.2 million is enough to make it the number one in a runaway on this list of best-selling records. You mentioned, Bill, that these top sellers, The Bodyguard, Saturday Night Fever, Eagles' Greatest Hits, that these may stay the best-selling records for a long time. With the changes in the industry, what are the chances of somebody like Adele, with her runaway bestseller, ever making it onto the top 10?
Well, it's funny. You can do the math. We can do the math ourselves. So it sold 10 million in the United States. It's very big overseas. Let's say it sold another 10 million overseas. So it's at 20 million. The United States, roughly speaking, 40 to 50% of worldwide record sales. So mm-hmm. you can basically start out with that. So seriously, she's at 20 million. She sells 1.5 million records for the next 20 years. Right? She can,
well,
if she can get if people do that, you can kind of imagine 15, 20 years from her now, her getting into that realm. On the other hand, Grease, Dark Side of the Moon, The Bodyguard, Saturday Night Fever, they're going to keep selling as well.
Mm-hmm.
So those figures are going to increase. So, but so that's one thing. You can kind of see that scenario. And I'm a little bit skeptical because, first of all, with file sharing, so many people today, so many kids just share the albums digitally with their friends.
Right.
That so much of the records they buy online, they don't have digital rights management anymore, so it's easy to share them. There's illegal downloading everywhere. The United States record market is about 40 to 45% of what it was 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very unusual that that you have something that sells like Adele. Now, 10 years ago, the biggest record of the year sold 10 million copies, or say 9 million in 1 year. And Adele's only been selling about 4 million a year.
Right.
So you can see right there that sort of big burst. And I don't even know how many albums Jackson sold in the first couple of years of Thriller, but it was a lot more than 10 million.
And the idea of someone selling 1.5 million albums in any year, let alone every year for the next 20 years in this current market seems a little far-fetched. So
it does. Now Guillaume makes a very interesting argument here. He says, look, you're thinking about normal patterns, but a blockbuster isn't normal.
That's true.
And that you could have it's not going to be Adele, but you could have a new Michael Jackson who comes out, you know, and sells 35 million records in a couple of years and really puts him or herself in the running. So I take that point. It's just hard to see that person on the horizon now. But who saw Michael Jackson on the horizon at the time?
Well, 66.2 million records later, lots of people saw Michael Jackson on their own personal musical horizon, the best-selling album of all time, if not a 100 million seller, as claimed often by the industry. We've been parsing the numbers with Bill Wyman, who wrote about Michael Jackson for The New Yorker. He's been on the line with us from KJZZ Studios in Tempe, Arizona. Bill, nice speaking with you.
John, thank you very much.
This is Soundcheck.
She was more like a beauty queen from a movie scene. I said, don't mind, but what do you mean? I am the one to go dance on the floor and around. She said, I am the one who would dance on the floor and around. She told me
Wyman wrote about Thriller for the New Yorker blog. There's a link to his story on our site, soundcheck.org. Coming up, Bhangra Funk comes to our studio when the New York group Red Barat performs live. That's next. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The band Red Barat makes a sound they describe as Brooklyn Bhangra, a collision of genres that brings together Punjabi rhythms and New Orleans brass, maybe a bit of New York hip-hop thrown in for good measure. The band has had a busy year playing places as diverse as Bonnaroo, the Paralympic Games in London, and the White House. Their new album, called Shruggy G, is out on January 22nd, but we're getting a preview here in the studio today. Probably the best way to experience this high-octane band. Here's a live performance of the title track from the forthcoming album Shruggy G by the band Red Barat.
One, two, three, four!
That is the band Red Barat, live on Soundcheck, with the title track of their forthcoming album called Shruggy G. I'll introduce you to the full band in a moment. First, meet Sonny Jane. Good to see you again, Sonny.
How you doing, John?
Sonny singing and playing the dol, which is this South Asian barrel drum. So you're singing in three languages. I mean, there's English, what I assume is Punjabi, and then the syllables that drummers use to learn the strokes on the drum, it seems.
Yeah, the bowls, the Hindustani bowls,
right.
Is what we did at the end, and a little English and a little Hindi in there.
Is it Hindi? Okay.
Yeah. Really, on the record, actually, though, we have a rapper on there, Miwi
right.
LaLupa, our bass trumpet player, who was unfortunate, couldn't join us today, but that's what we're doing today.
All right. Well, with you today, let's run down the brass section first. On saxophone, Michael Bomwell. On trumpet, Sonny Singh. The trombone played by Ernest Stewart. And the sousaphone, the tuba-like instrument played by John Altieri. The percussion section, you've met Sonny Jane. Toma Fujiwara behind our drum kit and Rohin Kimani playing still more percussion. And this, I mean, this is a, you know, you see this combination of horns and drums mm-hmm. in many cultures around the world. The specific culture, Sonny, that you were drawn to is this kind of Punjabi thing, right? The where Bhangra comes from?
It's a mixture of the Punjabi Bhangra rhythms, but also fused with the colonial marching bands that are present in India since the 18th century. Stuff that I remember going there, seeing my uncles getting married and dhol players showing up, these marching bands showing up and playing music. And so it's looking back at that, culling everything from that sound, but of course putting our Brooklyn sound, our American mm-hmm. sound on it with the jazz, the go-go, as you heard in Shruggy G, and, you know,
go-go being the Washington, D.C. kind of funk style.
Yes, yes, yes mm-hmm. indeed, yeah.
The name Red Barat, what is a barat?
So a barat is it's that procession that happens in a wedding. Oftentimes you see it in North India. It's really all throughout India. It's almost like the territory bands of the 30s back in America, where there's so many different barat bands and marching bands just found in different cities and locales within India and Pakistan as well. And the barat is the procession that happens when the groom's side is kind of taking off to go meet the bride's side. So it's this big kind of cacophonous sound and dancing and singing, and it's a big celebration.
Mm-hmm. And so you got to witness this as a kid?
Yeah, it was. I was 5 years old when I went to go see my uncle get married. This is my first conscious recollection of India. And I remember going out in the streets and just being wowed by the fact that my cousin was able to get on the horse with my uncle, because typically you have the youngest son is typically on the horse with the groom. And then this band showed up and started playing, and I'm 5 years old, like, what is going on right now? And then about 30 minutes later, a couple dhol players showed up, not even playing with the band, just kind of off on the other side, just jamming out. So, you know, I remember that experience just being five, being young, impressionable, wondering what is going on, how long is this going for? Mom, how long are we walking for? I mean, it went on what seemed for like hours.
Why can't
really
I be on a horsey too?
Yeah. Exactly.
So this is wedding music. When you formed the band here in the city, was mm-hmm. it still wedding music?
Yeah, yeah. We've done many weddings. When we're back home in Brooklyn, we definitely love to do it. I mean, it's like the beginning of the ceremony, so it's like everyone's decked out, everyone's smiling, everyone's there to dance. So it's not your typical wedding.
What are you implying? Game. It's the beginning and everyone's smiling. Or what happens at the end? Is a fisticuffs?
That's happened on occasion, actually. Actually, you know, we've had pennies thrown at the sousaphone too during the barat.
We're listening to the band Red Barat. That's spelled B-A-R-A-A-T. Their new album coming out on January 22nd is called Shruggy G. So Shruggy G is basically a dance. You shrug your shoulders, you shake your ankles.
It's a dance, but also the G, it's not the letter G, but J-I as in respect. And so Shruggy G is that kind of mythical character that lives within all of us, you know, that shadow that disappears at night and comes out on the dance floor and everyone's shrugging their shoulders.
Now, the record includes a couple of, like, older songs, you know, this song Must Kalander, which, you know, we've heard in this studio sung by Kavali singers and folk musicians. And there's also a couple of Bollywood tunes as well, in addition to things that you guys have written yourselves.
Absolutely, yeah. We opened up, you were playing that track, Dama the Must Kalander, which features Sunny Singh, you know, singing on that. And it is a very old Sufi traditional song. And a couple other nice little budgens in there, devotional songs.
All on this record called Shruggy G. The band's, I guess this will be your record release party on February 1st at the Bowery Ballroom here in New York. It's been a big year. Bonnaroo, I mentioned the Paralympic Games in London. What were you doing at the White House?
We were jamming out. we were invited to play over there in April for the API, Asian American and Pacific Islanders Initiative, that Clinton had signed back, you know, years ago, went dormant during the Bush years, and Barack Obama reinstated it. And it's essentially looking at how to publicly and philanthropically private funding those communities. So we were invited to go over there and play, and it was wild. You know, we're over there just jamming out, and Secretary of Education, Secretary of Labor, just there dancing in front of us, you know.
Nice. All right, the band is Red Barat, and we're going to hear another song that's coming out on the new record, Shruggy G. This one, this is one of your original compositions.
This is another original. This is written by our percussionist, actually, Rohan, and it's called Burning Instinct.
Okay, once again, Red Barat, live on Soundcheck.
One, two, three, four. We'll be right back.
Barat, the band playing live here in our Soundcheck studio, and that song's called Burning Instinct. They're playing February 1st at the Bowery Ballroom, but playing for us here in the studio today. The forthcoming record is Shruggy G. It's out on January 22nd. The band is Red Barat. This music's it's a lot of fun, and guys, thank you so much for bringing the fun into our studio today.
Thank you, John.
Going to do it for Soundcheck today. There's more music and more conversation with Red Barat on our website. Go to soundcheck.org. And tomorrow, join us at 2 p.m. Eastern on soundcheck.org for The Relatives. This Dallas-based gospel group has been at it for 40 years, adding touches of James Brown and Funkadelic to the traditional gospel sound. You can watch them perform in a live video webcast on soundcheck.org tomorrow at 2. Then on the air at 9, the Academy Award categories for Best Song and Best Score got a bit of a shake-up this year with some eligibility changes. We'll hear about this year's nominees, plus music from the Afrofunk ensemble Debo Band. That's tomorrow night at 9. See you then. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.